Rachel.
And this is Unassigned Reading,
where we discuss the books you're never going to talk about in English class.
Right. YA, sci-fi, fantasy, and all the other genres you read for fun.
Obviously, this is not a spoiler-free podcast.
So many spoilers.
Soul-splitting spoilers, you might even say.
You might, since we're discussing Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince today.
And there's that whole thing with Voldemort killing a bunch of people and splitting his soul to create Horcruxes and living forever.
Well, we're really not wasting any time with the spoilers this week, are we?
Well, I thought I'd go ahead and give you a head start on your summary. One less thing you have to talk about now.
Oh boy, it's a long book. There's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, there really is. But it's your turn, and if I had to do the horror show of a summary that was Order of the Phoenix and was like 200 pages longer than this one, then you can definitely survive this. So I am going to put 60 seconds on the clock.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. And here we go.
Okay, so Dumbledore gets Harry from the Dursleys. They go and convince Slughorn to be a teacher at Hogwarts. They go to the Dursleys for a minute, and then they all go to Hogwarts because everyone's freaking out. And there's, like, a lot of security because Voldemort's back. And Slughorn turns out to be the potions professor. Now Snape's teaching defense against the dark arts, so that's no good. Also, Harry thinks Malfoy's being super suspicious, and he's convinced that he's up to no good and a Death Eater. Then they go to Hogsmeade, and Katie Bell touches an enchanted amulet and, like, almost dies. And Harry's sure it's Malfoy, but no one else believes him, including Dumbledore, who's teaching him about Voldemort's past. And then Ron drinks some poison that was meant for Dumbledore, and Harry's sure it's Malfoy, but still no one believes him, and they figure out, as they go through Voldemort's past, that he's been creating Horcruxes, and Harry has to go get a memory from Slughorn that goes into more detail about, like, what Voldemort was trying to do with the Horcruxes, and...
Stop.
No!
I liked that long pause at the end there.
I was like, okay, should I just jump straight to them going to get the Horcrux? And I was like, yeah, I should jump straight to the Horcrux.
Yeah,
I'm almost out of time.
You should have jumped there like 20 seconds earlier.
I should have left everything out about Ron. That wasn't important. So
that wasn't terrible, minus missing the whole end of the book. A few key points before that, though, that we probably ought to mention. First of all, is that Snape, we know at the very beginning of the book, makes an unbreakable vow to Narcissa Malfoy to protect Draco. That's a pretty important detail that comes up again. Yeah, I feel like you got most of the important kind of intervening moment.
Until you get to the end,
well,
where
except,
I missed
of course,
everything.
Well, yeah, you miss everything, but I guess we should also probably mention, like, where the title comes from. I know that's not a detail that's, like, maybe super important when you're just picking and choosing what to talk about, but... Yeah, Harry has this potion book because he doesn't think he's going to be able to take potions until he realizes that Slughorn is the new potion teacher and he got a high enough score on his OWLs that he can take it now. And anyway, he winds up getting this used book that has a lot of notes in the margins and on how to, like, do potions better. And suddenly he becomes this amazing potion master. And the book used to belong to somebody called the Half-Blood Prince. And in the end, we find out it was actually Snape. And then, of course, like you said, yeah, the whole end we didn't get to. You said that Harry's been learning about Voldemort's past and the Horcruxes, and so he and Dumbledore go on a mission at the end because Dumbledore thinks he's found one of the Horcruxes. They go to this little cave off of the ocean. They go through all of these trials through, like, across this lake and the cave to lock it in this island at the center of the lake. Then they get back to Hogwarts, and there's the Death Eaters have come to Hogwarts, and Draco's, like, about to murder Dumbledore on the, I think it's the Astronomy Tower, isn't it?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, on the Astronomy Tower, and Dumbledore, like, freezes Harry under the invisibility cloak so he can't do anything, and Draco's faltering, he's probably not gonna do it, but the other Death Eaters are coming. Then Snape shows up, and Snape kills Dumbledore, and then Harry finds out that Snape was the Half-Blood Prince, and he chases after him, and yeah, things are bad.
And then a very critical point at the very end, Harry opens the locket, and it's not the right locket. The Horcrux is missing.
It was taken by somebody called R.A.B. So I think that's, like, a pretty good general summary.
Yeah, I think everybody's up to speed now.
The highlights, maybe a little more than necessary even. So let's jump into it.
Okay.
So the first thing I want to talk about, and this is such a random little thing, but it stuck out to me so much, I really wanted to bring it up and see what your thoughts on it are. This book, like several of the past books, does not begin with Harry. we begin with other scenes kind of setting up some large plot points in the book. And in this one, we see Bellatrix Lestrange and Narcissa Malfoy going to see Snape and doing the whole unbreakable vow thing, as we discussed. And the last time I read this book, and I think this is true for you as well, I hadn't read Cursed Child.
Right.
So this time there were a couple of things that caught my eye that obviously wouldn't have really meant very much to me before. And they seemed kind of meaningful this time, knowing what we know from Cursed Child, which, not to totally spoil Cursed Child, but I'm about to spoil Cursed Child, so go ahead and if you haven't, like, seen it or read the book and you don't want spoilers, just, like, skip ahead a couple of minutes, because I don't want to spoil it for anybody who doesn't want to be spoiled, even though I know we already warned everybody about spoilers. Basically, for those of you who are familiar with Cursed Child, now that everyone else has skipped ahead, I just want to, like, draw everybody's attention to a couple of moments and comments from Bellatrix to see what you made of them, knowing what we know from Cursed Child.
Okay, I'm gonna, before you get into this, I'm gonna give you fair warning. I don't remember anything from Cursed Child. I had no idea this is the direction you were going, so
you'll remember this.
This will be a surprise to me.
You'll remember. Okay. This. It's not like a minuscule detail. You will remember the point I'm talking about.
Okay.
So first I'm just going to say the two comments from Bellatrix. So the first one that stood out to me is she just kept talking about how Bellatrix sees herself as the most kind of beloved servant of the Dark Lord. And she's talking about how he shares everything with me. He calls me his most loyal, his most faithful. And then she says, the Dark Lord in the past has entrusted me with his most precious. You know, she's like talking about how he trusts her the most. And then when Narcissa is getting really upset about the fact that Draco's probably being punished because of Lucius's failures in the past and that he's probably going to die in his mission. And Bellatrix says, you should be proud. If I had sons, I would be glad to give them up in service to the Dark Lord. So maybe now you see where I'm going with this.
A little.
Because, obviously, we know from Cursed Child that within, I did some math here, so follow along. Within about the next year, she's going to have a child with Voldemort. And we don't know exactly when this child is born, but what we do know is that it was sometime between when Bellatrix escaped from Azkaban in 1996 and when she and Voldemort were killed in March of 1998. So doing some math there, we know she had to be pregnant at the latest by the summer of 1997, which I think would just about coincide with when this scene takes place, if I'm not messing up on the timeline here. So those lines, I didn't figure out the math on that until later as I was going back through. But those lines still really stood out to me because I felt like they could be referencing the fact of this idea that Bellatrix is going to have a child with Voldemort.
Well,
and that was really interesting to me because when I read Cursed Child, and I think you probably took this a little bit the same way, I kind of assumed that a lot of that was after the fact, you know?
Yeah.
That wasn't stuff that was planned from the beginning of this series, like so much of Harry Potter is. And I don't know, it's hard to say because none of those lines are like direct enough that you could really say, oh, for sure she's referencing that she's pregnant or thinks she might be going to have a child, or even just the idea that J.K. Rowling knew that she was going to be having a child with Voldemort, whether or not Bellatrix knew at this point. But I think it could be read that way. Like, I definitely saw it as being a possibility this time when I was reading it, just because we do know that J.K. Rowling, as a writer, tends to plan things out that intricately. And so seeing those little things this time, I guess what I'm wondering, since we both have mixed feelings about Cursed Child 2 especially, do you think that she did already have that maybe in the back of her mind as a possibility when she was writing this scene?
So, to me, it reads more like sort of backing into it. This was just meant to be showing Bellatrix's level of devotion. Because, I mean, for one, I don't really accept Cursed Child as canon, which we're going to talk about later.
I know this. I know this, and I'm kind of in the same boat. But this made me think about it a little differently, at least that aspect of it. There are still a lot of other aspects of Cursed Child that I disagree with.
To me, it's still...
But that part, I thought, it made me wonder if this might have been a plan from the beginning.
Yeah.
Whether or not Cursed Child as a story was a plan, it made me wonder if that plot line was something she had already thought about.
It could be. I think it's not enough for me to be certain that it was, but it is enough to be, well, maybe this wasn't just backtracked.
Oh, me either. I mean, it's very vague kind of allusions, but also the fact that timeline-wise, if we take the idea that maybe she did already know, like, it's very possible that Bellatrix was pregnant in this scene.
Yeah, that's definitely interesting. It's an interesting thing to think about. Was the idea of a child already sort of in J.K. Rowling's mind, and she sort of put in a vague reference and then maybe didn't really go anywhere with it later, but left herself the opportunity to go somewhere with it later.
Yeah.
So it could be that, or it could be not related, but because it's there, it's help beneficial for the people who wrote her child to sort of be like, look, you know, sort of,
yeah,
like in the way that a lot of when you read like fan fiction or something, you sort of find these lines and like tie things back in from these lines, especially with the stuff that happens before or after the series. It's pretty easy to do that. A lot of people do that.
Yeah,
that's sort of my favorite kind of fan fiction. Like I said,
they're vague lines. Nothing in there is directly saying that she has or is planning to have a child. I just thought it was interesting.
It is definitely interesting.
When I read Cursed Child, I thought it was totally out of the blue, that other than the fact that she and Voldemort were obviously kind of close, there were no possible allusions or references to it. And then when I was reading the scene, I was like, wait a moment.
That is very interesting, to read it sort of in light of Cursed Child. That is very interesting.
Yeah, that was definitely not something I went into this book with the intention of doing, let me tell you.
Yes. So this sort of also, this scene opens us up to Draco's plot line here.
Yes.
What becomes Harry's obsession for the year.
And that is such an important plot line in this book, because Draco has probably the biggest storyline that he ever has in the series. And in particular, with the way that his story kind of ties in with Harry's, because like you said, Harry becomes full-on obsessed. Low-key definitely see the connection to Carry On there by Rainbow Rowell.
Yeah.
Like, you see where the idea for Simon being totally obsessed with Boz comes from.
Because Harry's very obsessed.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that I think is really, really interesting about that is the way that J.K. Rowling uses our own doubts about Harry's ability to see reason and think rationally when it comes to Draco. Mm-hmm. And also, as the story goes on, to Snape as well.
Yeah.
And to use that to make us and the other characters doubt the evidence that he's compiling, because he has some really good evidence when you look at it.
We even know things Harry doesn't from the chapter with Snape.
Right, because we see this scene at the beginning. So we're like, of course, Harry's right. But there's still this aspect of, you know, she's using Harry's bias and what mm-hmm. everybody knows about his tendency to loathe Malfoy and also to kind of be a little headstrong and get things wrong sometimes, particularly in light of everything that happened in the last book, I think, and to kind of make that more reasonable doubt than might otherwise be there.
Well, and I also saw this sort of is the way, so we talked a lot about how Harry's trauma expresses itself in the last book, and it's different in this book. Like, he's gone through bad stuff and he's not lashing out quite as much as he did in book five. And I think what he's really moved on to here is he is focusing all of his issues on Malfoy, mostly, and to some extent Snape, but like mostly on Malfoy. That's his whole focus. Everything that's wrong is Malfoy. Malfoy's up to no good. And so you don't believe Harry because you know he's not in a good place. And even though there's so much evidence, and it's really good evidence, you're like, I don't think Harry's right, because you know he's just looking for something, you know?
Right, yeah, and this, like you said, the same really goes for Snape as well, because he's also pushing a lot of his own guilt and self-blame for Sirius's death onto Snape.
Because he wants it to be Snape's fault. It's Snape's fault that Sirius went there and Sirius died. It wasn't Harry's fault for, you know.
Exactly, because I think he even basically says at one point it's easier to blame someone else than to blame himself.
Yeah.
And that one's really interesting as well, because talking about how there's a bit of a switcheroo there with Malfoy, like making everyone think that Malfoy isn't guilty when really Harry's right.
Yeah.
But then with Snape, we get kind of that double switcheroo, because
I was about to mention that.
Yeah, we have Harry, and this one really, it is the reader doubting Harry's suspicion more so than with Draco, because with Draco, as you said, we do kind of have evidence along with Harry that not anyone else knows as readers that Harry's right. But with Snape, you know, we've still got the, we're trusting Dumbledore, and Harry has always thought Snape was a bad guy and always hated
and
Snape.
And had issues with
Snape. And Snape has always been good, and Dumbledore's always believed in him. And so we don't really believe those suspicions, and we trust Dumbledore. So then when we see, oh wait, no, actually Harry was right about not only Draco, but Snape as well, and we see Snape, you know, straight up murder Dumbledore, we have that moment of, oh no, we've been wrong this whole time. Snape really is the bad guy, which of course, again, spoilers for anyone who hasn't read book 7, but yeah, then we find out that actually that's not true either.
Which is not to say that Snape's a good guy, which we're going to talk a lot about Snape in the next one.
Snape
I think
is a complicated character.
We need to save most of our discussion of Snape for the next book because you only have half the story in this book. So
right, and we don't want to dive too deeply into that just yet.
Yeah, because I think we're going to have a lot to say about Snape.
Yeah,
but Malfoy,
he's a complicated character. But as is Malfoy.
Malfoy is too, but I do think there's more development with Malfoy in the next book, but I think we get the majority of, we get what we need about Malfoy here to discuss what he's done, because...
I agree, and we definitely do get a more complex view of him in this book. Continues to become more complicated over the next book as well. Because, yeah, on the one hand, we see him acting more cruelly and violently, I think, than we ever have before. I mean, we see him straight up about to perform the Cruciatus Curse on Harry toward the end.
Yeah.
On the other hand, at the same time, we see that he's really, really torn up about this. Like, we know from when Harry and Ron stumble across Moaning Myrtle that there's been a boy who's been crying in the bathroom and is really upset, and we eventually find out that that is Draco, and see him crying, Harry does, when he eventually stumbles upon him, and they have that whole terrible fight. But yeah, so I think it's really interesting that we're seeing this, on the one hand, we are seeing this really terrible side of Draco when he really has finally become not only the nemesis that he kind of has been, but almost a minor villain in this book, because he really does come pretty close to killing several
people.
Yeah, and
this is definitely where he makes the jump from bully to villain.
Yeah, bully to bad guy, kind of. In the end, though, again, kind of complicating this view is when he's trying to sort of amp himself up to killing Dumbledore, which Dumbledore is like, Draco, we both know you're not going to do this, and he doesn't. But he's talking about how if he doesn't do this, Voldemort's going to kill him and his whole family. And in the end, even Harry is kind of like, you know, I feel really bad for Draco. I can't even imagine what Voldemort's doing to him now that he failed his mission and to his family. And I think even Harry realizes what a terrible position he was put in, and without really a lot of the resources Harry has had to fight back against it.
Yeah, I think this is a good moment for Harry, too. We see him showing empathy for his nemesis, because he's never liked Draco. He and Draco have always been at odds.
And I think that's a big moment for Harry, to be able to say, here's a guy who's done a really bad thing. And we see him do it a little bit with Voldemort, too, even. As he's beginning to learn about Voldemort's past, that's another pretty big aspect of this book, is the lessons Harry's having with Dumbledore, where they are going into all of these memories to learn more about Tom Riddle as a boy and as a teenager before he became Lord Voldemort. And at one point, Dumbledore is kind of like, oh, Harry, are you feeling bad for Lord Voldemort? Because Harry's like, his mother didn't even try to live for him. And I think it's interesting that we do see Harry starting to be able to see a more complicated view, even of the bad guys in this world. And not that it excuses their actions, but that he can sort of see... This reminds me again of Snape, which we're going to talk about more in the next book, of how life experiences don't necessarily excuse the terrible things people do, but that they might help explain them, and maybe you can still feel bad for people even when they've done terrible things.
And since you mentioned Voldemort's past, I want to talk more about that. And specifically, something sort of odd that I picked up on with this reading. So I'm going to sort of do a quick overview of Voldemort's past so I can sort of lead this into my point. So Voldemort's mother was, like, kicked out of her home. He's born into an orphanage where his mother immediately dies, so he's immediately orphaned. He's learns from a young age that he's special. Even though he's bullied, he realizes that there's something special about him. He does bad things, but he's got more control over his magic than someone his age should.
Yeah, he's a bit of a child prodigy,
right?
Really.
And, you know, he gets found, he goes to Hogwarts, he gets to go to magic school, and he's a good student, he's driven, he's a prefect. And it's interesting, just not only the parallels between him and Harry, but it reads very much like a YA hero. He could be the hero if he wasn't so bad. Like,
if he weren't so very, very evil, he could be the hero.
But it's sort of the circumstances you see for a lot of heroes, where he's special and he realizes he's special and he goes to Hogwarts.
Yeah, and
he's
had a very
best.
Difficult upbringing. He's there, as you said, there really are a lot of parallels to Harry there. You know, he's raised as an orphan. Hogwarts becomes his home and really his safe place, the place he doesn't want to leave and always wants to come. And in fact, even Harry starts to make those parallels when he's learning about Voldemort's past. He's thinking, wow, we're quite similar in our background and our upbringing and the way that we feel about Hogwarts.
Yeah, and also I think there's this incredible sort of comparison between their parents, because Harry, you know, he's raised for the first year of his life, very loving parents who, you know, shower him with love, and in his parents' death, you know, protect him, sort of protecting him with love. And Voldemort, it's not mentioned in this book, I think it comes up in book 7, but we do learn in this book that his father was under the influence of a love potion.
Yeah, we learn that in this book.
And I believe in the next book we learn, I'm not sure if it's said explicitly or if it's just implied, but basically that someone who's conceived under... So if you're conceived when one parent is under the influence of a love potion, you don't have the ability to love.
I don't know that that's ever explicitly said, but I think it's definitely something that can be extrapolated.
And we can talk more about if we think that's right or not, but I've always taken that opinion that, like, Voldemort...
I've definitely always thought that was a factor, and definitely, again, sort of a foil to Harry, whose parents loved each other so much and loved him so much that his mother literally gave her life for him to live, whereas Voldemort, as you said, was conceived under a love potion, not from love, although his mother did love his father. And then his mother was just so devastated that she couldn't even live for him.
Yeah.
So I think there's definitely a bit of a, you know, contrast.
And so
there.
That's, like, the difference between them. Because in most other ways, their childhoods are very, very similar. But this is the thing that sort of defines them and leads them on their different paths. As Harry, he knows what love is, and he loves very strongly. And Voldemort doesn't have that.
Right. And I do think, well, again, these are topics we'll probably talk about even more in the next book, but I think, as Dumbledore has said in the past in a very great quote, it's their choices that make them who they are. You know, it's not just where they came from or the things that happened to them, but they both make very different choices in life. You know, it's kind of going back to book one when Harry's thinking, not Slytherin, not Slytherin, not that there's anything wrong with Slytherin, but that's a choice that he makes because he, in his very short time in the wizarding world, has been made to see that, or think that, Slytherin is solely evil. And he's he kind of already is worried about that and wants to be a good person and a good wizard. And so he's already actively making the choice to do the right thing and be the good person.
Yeah.
Whereas Voldemort, already at that age, is wanting to accumulate power. So we see very different choices happening even in their young lives.
I need to say something really quick.
Okay.
You're my best friend.
Thank you. I mean, very random, but you're my best friend, too.
And if you're a best friend or a fan of friendship in general, you should check out Best Forevers.
It's a podcast all about friendship. But let's hear a description straight from the source.
I'm Elisa Lucas from Best Forevers, a podcast for kindred spirits. I'd like to start a movement where we spend more time loving on our friends, because although friends are important to us, they're often in the shadow of other relationships. So if you want to love on your friendships a little bit more, embrace friendship a little bit more, or just appreciate your friendships a little bit more, then this podcast is for you. We'll explore all the different ways friendships take place, share the amazing stories of friendship, and discuss best practices for the difficulties that friends may experience. It's time to embrace friendships, because without our friends, who would we be? So check out Best Forevers on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the other podcasting listening venues. And be sure to follow Best Forevers Pod on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.
Now let's get back to one of the most iconic friend groups of all time, Harry, Ron, and Hermione. And speaking about Voldemort's past, that also brings us to another very important plot point that we learn about in this book, which is the idea of Horcruxes. And Horcruxes are these objects where a person has concealed part of their soul. You know, I definitely think, looking back, we can see some hints leading up to this, that it was an idea that was kind of already in play, but nothing, I think, that would lead us to guess that this is where we were going exactly. Yeah. But, you know, as Dumbledore points out in this book, there was the diary, which was the first Horcrux that was destroyed, really in a stroke of luck that they were able to do that, which we'll probably get to more in the next book as well. And Voldemort has made some references in the past to having gone farther than anyone else to achieve death, and the fact that he wasn't killed. To achieve immortality. He's not trying to achieve death. And even just the fact that he did survive when he killed Harry, because that's never really been something that we have been made to understand. Like, how was the killing curse rebounded, and then yet he still continued to exist in some form or another? We just, up to this point, I think we're kind of like, oh, it's magic.
Yeah.
You know, it's a magical world. Anything can happen. But now we know why. It's because Voldemort has done these terrible things to become essentially immortal. But one of the things that I thought was interesting is, so I studied a little bit of Russian fairy tales when I was in school.
Once again, we're lying about this whole podcast because Rachel studied
it. Total lies. I'm sorry I took such weird classes in college. And I think that probably a lot of the people, at least in the U.S., are maybe not as familiar with Russian fairy tales. I know I certainly wasn't before reading them. I was much more familiar with, you know, Brothers Grimm and Hans Christian Andersen and, mm-hmm. you know, those kinds of fairy tales.
Yeah, I'm only and familiar with, like, two.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think, like, pretty much everybody knows, like, Baba Yaga.
Baba Yaga, which I always...
the old witch lady living in a house with chicken feet.
Yeah, and that's the one I always say wrong. And then... Firebird is Russian, yeah?
Right, because ballet.
Yes, yeah, so I know that because I did ballet, but yeah.
Right, otherwise, and actually that's funny because what I'm about to say is vaguely related to the Firebird because this is a villain character used in the Firebird. Anyway, as I was studying some of those Russian fairy tales, I came across a character that struck me as possibly being interestingly related to Harry Potter, which is not something I ever would have anticipated going into reading Russian fairy tales. But there's a character, and in Russian fairy tales and in Slavic folklore in general, one of the kind of differences is that characters tend to be more archetypal. They're used over and over again, versus in a lot of European fairy tales where we might see different versions of the same story, or like a character might show up in a couple of different ones, but usually Sleeping Beauty is in her fairy tale, and The Little Mermaid is in her fairy tale, and Hansel and Gretel are in there. You know, like, they're not necessarily showing up in a ton of different fairy tales mm-hmm. as the exact same character, with kind of the exception of Snow White. But in Slavic fairy tales, these characters will show up time and time again. Like, Baba Yaga shows up all the time, and Prince Ivan shows up all the time, and these characters that keep reoccurring. And one of them is called Koshi the Deathless. And you may already see where I'm going with this.
I've gotten a hint.
Yeah, the Deathless gives you a bit of a hint there. And basically, the reason I saw a connection here is because this is a villain character in Russian fairy tales who hides his death. So his death is hidden in, usually it's the same thing, but it's hidden away in an object. And usually people will ask him where he's hidden his death because you can't kill him when his death is hidden somewhere else. You have to find his death in order to kill him. And he'll say, you know, increasingly outlandish things like, oh, it's in the broom, it's in the goat. And then finally it's hidden in the sea in an island. And on that island there stands an oak, and under the oak a coffer is buried, and in the coffer is a hare, and in the hare is a duck, and in the duck is an egg, and in the egg is my death. Or sometimes it's in a needle in the egg and the... in the duck and the hay, you know. Anyway, on and on, kind of ridiculous things. And it's this idea that his soul isn't split, but it is hidden away outside of his body, usually in an object, and in this case, kind of a ridiculous object. But that struck me as very similar to the idea of Horcruxes, which was not something I had ever come across anything similar before.
Yeah.
And this struck me as something that was a little bit surprisingly similar, and it did make me wonder if J.K. Rowling may have had some exposure to some Slavic folklore. Just because that idea did seem kind of related to me.
Yeah.
So I wondered if it was a possible inspiration for it. I wasn't able to find anything to back that up on the internet other than just the own connections I drew. It does look like a few other people have seen the connection, people who've seen Koshi the Deathless as a character and also are familiar with Harry Potter, but I wasn't able to find any information that was more concrete than that. Yeah. But I do think it's an interesting possible parallel.
It is super interesting. And we do know that J.K. Rowling pulled from a lot of different areas of knowledge that she has to sort of create the world of Harry Potter.
Of Greek and Roman mythology. I know she studied classics in school, and we definitely see a lot of that background, mm-hmm. I think, used in the Wizarding World mythology. So I think it's definitely possible that she came across that in her studies or just in, you know, her own personal life.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah. So I think another thing we have to talk about in relation to book six is the romance.
Yeah, I left that out of my summary because I was like, I don't know what to say about all of this.
Yeah. Well, because this is the first book we've really seen. Romance has come up briefly in some of the other books. You know, we've seen Harry's had his big old crush on Cho for several books that finally kind of faded. And, of course, there's always been sort of a will they, won't they with Ron and Hermione that everyone's always known about since book one or two. But this is the first book where we see things really starting to move forward in that department. And it's kind of, like, it's a bit of a departure from the previous books.
Yes.
And so the two main couples that we've got in this one are Ron and Hermione and Harry and Ginny.
Although neither of those couples get together until close to the end of things.
Well, Ron and Hermione never exactly get
together. Right, they don't actually get together. They just sort of, Ron breaks up with Lavender Brown and they're friends again.
Right, that's because as far Ron as and Lavender, that's a whole thing that I didn't even mention, which is, ridiculous.
Well, this is also the book where there are all these characters, because we've had a big shift here from the past two books, everyone hated Harry. Harry was the worst. And now,
everyone's full on in love with him.
Everyone's coming out of the woodwork to, like, try and sneak him love potions.
Right, yeah, because he's like, Harry's the chosen one. We all want to date him now,
yeah,
obviously. And Harry's like, okay, cool. I'll take it. So I think for both of us, we were Ron / Hermione and Harry / Ginny shippers. We didn't really... I don't think either one of us particularly deviated on any of the major ships in Harry Potter, as I know a lot of people did. I was not into Harry, Hermione. It's like, no, thank you.
I was not either. With very few exceptions, I tend to be in the canon ships. There are a couple of exceptions to that.
I sometimes deviate more now, but definitely as a child, I was very much like, let's go with the canon ships. I don't think it ever even really occurred to me not to.
Also, I just felt strongly that Ron was right for Hermione and Harry was not. And I like Ginny and Harry.
I'll be honest. As I've grown older, like, I definitely was like that when I was younger. I don't know that I as strongly feel that Ron and Hermione are perfect for each other, but I do feel very strongly that Harry and Ginny are and that Harry and Hermione are not.
Yes, I would say more... Yeah, I'd agree. I feel very strongly still that Harry and Hermione are not right for each other. I can see maybe Ron and Hermione aren't perfect for each other, and maybe it's sort of the circumstances of the book that sort of bring them together in the way they are, but
yeah.
Harry and Hermione is never going to happen for me. It's just, nope, not right for each other.
Yeah, it's not happening. And I do think it's interesting because I wonder... You and I have talked about this a little leading up to this episode, but I wonder if one of the things that makes this book feel tonally like a departure from some of the others, mm-hmm. and in particular book 5, is this emphasis on romance, because it does give it a bit of a feeling of a lighter tone, you know?
Yes.
Like, it makes me think of, there was that edit of the HP6 trailer into a rom-com movie trailer. Do you remember that?
I do remember that. I'd forgotten about it till just now. That was
good.
Yeah,
because there is so much romance and a lot of just kind of ridiculous things.
Which is weird.
Going on.
Because you also have this whole very dark subplot of Harry's obsession on Draco, and they're learning about Horcruxes.
You have very dark subplots. You have the Draco obsession and also the fact that Draco, you know, the 16-year-old, is a Death Eater trying to kill Dumbledore. You have the whole storyline with Snape. You have learning about Voldemort's past and the Horcruxes. That's a pretty dark storyline. And, you know, obviously continued learning about how Harry is going to have to either kill or die at Voldemort's hand. But at the same time, you have a lot of funny moments where I almost feel like the characters are acting younger and more carefree than they have in a lot of the other books, almost.
Yeah.
Especially in comparison to book 5, which was so dark. And then, you have, like, the whole Felix Felicis scene, and you have,
good.
All of the kind of ridiculous Quidditch stuff that's going on. And so it feels a lot lighter in a lot of ways, and then you kind of have this huge, just explosive shift at the end from a fairly light tone to, bam, we're going to get a Horcrux, and things are going really badly, and Harry's having to force-feed Dumbledore this potion that's torturing him, and they're both badly hurt, and now we're going back, and Draco's a Death Eater, and he's about to kill Dumbledore, and then Snape kills Dumbledore, and Dumbledore's dead.
Yeah, I had this in book 5 too, but I remember the first time I read both this book and book 5, I didn't believe Sirius died and I didn't believe Dumbledore died. I was like Harry, because Harry doesn't believe at first, and it takes like a whole chapter, or not maybe a whole chapter, but it takes a bit for Harry to realize that they're dead. But yeah, it does.
Yeah.
The tone in this one's very different from book 5 and from book 7, is best I recall. Well, book 7's going to be very tonally different for a lot of reasons.
This book almost does feel like it's a bit of a break between 5 and 7, where it's kind of like, okay, 5, things got really dark, but now we're back at school and, you know, things are rough, but let's, like, take a moment to be kids again. And then in book 7, you know, we're off on the camping trip of death.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely... I also think some of the tone is also probably intentional, but, like, J.K. Rowling wanting to enjoy... Because she knows it's their last year of school. So she wants to get all the awesome Quidditch in and the romance and just all the school stuff in, because she knows it's not happening in the next book, even if we as readers don't realize
that. Well, yeah, because we didn't even mention this, but there's the whole heroic breakup eye roll thing going on with Harry and Ginny at the end of the book, speaking of not having as much romance in book 7.
Yeah.
It's like such the stereotypical, I can't put you in danger for myself. You
yeah.
know?
Oh, yeah.
It's a little bit rough. I get where Harry's coming from, but I also just kind of want to, like, slap him across the cheeks and be like, shut up, Harry.
Yeah.
Ginny's got this. Calm down.
Okay, so we've talked a little bit about tone and how Dumbledore and Dumbledore's death sort of fit in with that. So I think now we need to talk about Dumbledore in book 6.
And I know... we're really, really, really going to talk about him in relation to book 7, because that's when we get a lot more intricate exploration of Dumbledore's past and some of the mistakes he's made and how things go on without him. So we probably don't want to go too deeply into this, but there are a few things, like you said, I think we have to talk about in relation to book 6. So one of the things is, I think we really see in this book, it is kind of tragically sad for it to happen here, but we really see the depth of Harry and Dumbledore's relationship in this book in a couple of really sweet and touching moments. We have the whole, you know, I'm Dumbledore's man through and through thing that kind of even makes Dumbledore tear up a little. And then we have the scene at the end as they're leaving the cave where Harry tells him not to be worried and he says, I'm not worried, Harry, I'm with you. So we have some really touching moments there. But then he also straight up lies to Harry repeatedly in this book, in all of their private lessons. Because, you know, he said at the end of book 5, we talked about this a little, I'm going to tell you everything. And Harry even calls him on it in this one, because when they start their lessons, Harry's like, hold up, hold up. You said at the end of last term, you were going to tell me everything. And it even says in the book, it was hard to keep a note of accusation from his voice. And Dumbledore is like, I told you everything I know. From this point forth, we shall be leaving the firm foundation effect and journeying through the murky marshes of mystery into the thickets of wildest guesswork. From here on, Harry, I may be as woefully wrong as Humphrey Belcher, who believed the time was ripe for a cheese cauldron. Which is a great line. But, and I get that in fairness, that's not exactly a lie, although I think Dumbledore is the master of lying without lying.
Yeah.
You know, telling partial truths. Because he doesn't, I believe, especially rereading this book, he doesn't know for certain that Harry is a Horcrux.
But he doesn't know
but
for
he's
certain.
He's pretty dang sure.
He's like 90% sure that Harry is a Horcrux.
Yeah, but well, because again, he even admits shortly thereafter that, you know, he does think he's right, but he could be mistaken, and that being rather cleverer than most men, my mistakes tend to be correspondingly huger. Well, yeah, Dumbledore, I think maybe so.
Yeah.
Because he really does, as we learn more in book 7, he has this tendency to keep secrets because he thinks he's sort of playing everything out like a chessboard, and so he thinks he needs to keep the moves from the players, but leaving out huge things like the fact that Harry is a Horcrux and, you know, that Snape really is on their side and he's asked Snape to kill him and all this other stuff. So it's this really complicated thing, but I also do think it poses an interesting question here.
Okay.
Because we're really quick, I've been really quick even already, to argue that him hiding the truth from Harry, especially in the way that he does, and in saying that he's telling the truth this whole time, that, you know, he's doing something wrong. But what if Dumbledore had told him the whole truth? Like, let's just play that out for a second. What if, after Harry had procured the memory from Slughorn telling Tom Riddle about Horcruxes, and they discussed the 6 possible Horcruxes Dumbledore believes Voldemort to have made, what if he told Harry that he suspected a piece of Voldemort's soul had attached itself to Harry's? Like, what if he had actually done that? What do you think Harry's reaction would have been to that? Would he have still been able to go about his life and search out the Horcruxes in the next book and ultimately defeat Voldemort? Or would he have been so consumed by the idea that he wouldn't have been able to focus on anything else?
Yeah, as much as I hate to admit it, I think he probably wouldn't have been able to be as effective in book 7 of hunting down Horcruxes.
I agree.
The reason it all works is Harry's told that he's a Horcrux right at the end. He doesn't have any time to prepare. He doesn't have any time to do anything. He's just
and
like,
I think at that point he's kind of prepared for it, you know, because he's already sort of seeing he probably doesn't have any choice but to go through with this.
Yeah,
to giving himself up. We're getting way ahead of ourselves, but yeah, I agree.
Yeah, so I still think Dumbledore makes mistakes here, a lot of mistakes surrounding we know in the 7th book Dumbledore knows he's going to die this year, so and there are things he should have done that would have helped Harry more and the Order of the Phoenix more if he'd let them in on a few things, like why he trusts
Snape. I think
Snape.
We learn, you know, we talked about fatal flaws many an episode ago.
Yes.
And I think that might be Dumbledore's fatal flaw, is his tendency to keep everyone else out of the loop.
I definitely think you're right. And I think we can talk more about Dumbledore's fatal flaw in the next book, because it's going to come up a lot. But I do think you're right. And I do think we're seeing sort of a lifetime of doing this and thinking it's the right thing playing out here.
Right. And of course, as you said, we also learn why in the next book.
Yes.
And so we'll save that discussion for then. But yeah, I think that's a big thing with Dumbledore, is not trusting as much as he should. I also think, really quickly before we wrap up this episode, the one last thing we need to revisit that we, again, started to touch on in the last book is the prophecy. I think we need to come back to that for a second.
Okay.
Because we discussed in the last book how we see this as being a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Not as much so as some are portrayed to be, but definitely has some components of that. Mm-hmm. And I had totally forgotten about this when we had that discussion because, as I said, I think it's been quite a few years for both of us since we've reread this book. But Dumbledore and Harry pretty much have that exact conversation.
They did. It was pretty funny.
When I came across it, I was like, oh my gosh. I was like, this is what Sarah and I said. Yeah, because Harry keeps saying, he's like, whatever, Dumbledore, it all comes down to the same thing. You know, like, I've got to die or kill somebody. Quit getting into semantics here. Calm down. You know, about whether it matters that Voldemort chose him and all that. And Dumbledore's getting really worked up because he's like, you're setting too much store by the prophecy. And he basically says to Harry, you know, if Voldemort had never heard the prophecy, do you think it would have fallen out like this? Do you think it would have happened? Would it have meant anything? Or would the prophecy just have been another orb in the Hall of Prophecies? And yeah, so he basically poses the question to Harry, if nothing had played out as it had, if you had never heard the prophecy, how would you feel? Would you still feel like you needed to do this? And Harry thinks about it for a minute. He's like, yeah, I'd still feel like I needed to be the one to kill Voldemort because he killed my mom and dad and he's done all these terrible things and the world isn't going to be safe. And Dumbledore's like, yeah, plus he's still going to be trying to kill you regardless.
Yeah.
So I just thought it was interesting that Dumbledore gets so worked up over making sure Harry understands that this is his choice.
And I do think it's a lot of what we talked about in that it's happening because Voldemort tried to avert it. He tried to find a way out of it.
It was Dumbledore's choice that made the prophecy become
what it is. Or Voldemort's choice, not Dumbledore's.
What did I say?
Dumbledore's choice.
Oh, I thought I said Voldemort. Yeah, it's not Dumbledore's choice.
Voldemort's actions are what made the prophecy happen, or what are going to make the prophecy happen, because he tried to get out of it, and that's when the prophecy snares you, is when you try to get out of it.
Yeah, Dumbledore said, don't you see Voldemort himself created his worst enemy just as tyrants everywhere do? He heard the prophecy and leapt into action with the result that he not only handpicked the man most likely to finish him, he handed him uniquely deadly weapons. Which, again, I think he's also alluding to the whole Horcrux thing there, but
yes,
you know.
Dumbledore definitely alludes to the Horcrux thing a lot in this book.
He does. I just kind of wanted to shake him a little in this scene in the cave when he kept being like, oh no, Harry, your blood is so much more valuable. I was like, Dumbledore, I swear, if you talk about how valuable Harry's blood is one more time, I'm going to smack you.
Yeah. Well, I think on that note, we should wrap up.
Yeah, and I think that brings us to our favorite part of the show, the HP angst and sasso meters. So let's quickly go through those.
Okay.
So do you want to start with sass? How sassy is Harry in this book?
I'm going to give Harry a 7.
You are wrong.
Okay. What is
You the... are wrong. What it's is... a 10.
Really?
It is clearly a 10, Sarah. Did you forget that this has one of the best lines in the whole entire series? Oh. There's no need to call me Sir Professor. I'm sorry, that is peak Harry sass, okay?
You're right.
He is 16 years old and he just peaked. There is no need to call me Sir Professor. Mic drop, Harry out.
That is, you are right. I would say quantity-wise, there's less in this book than we saw in the last book, but quality-wise, you're right, Harry is at peak sass.
Yeah, you gotta give it a 10. There's just no other choice.
I'll agree with you, yeah, it's a 10.
Okay.
And now for Harry's angst.
Yeah. Oof. This one's hard because, like we talked about with tone, there's like such a range in this one.
Yeah.
I would say a good part of the book is like a solid 5, but then there are also so many dark parts in the end. So I'd give it more like a 7.
I was going to go 8. I think it, it's not as dark as, or as angsty.
It's not like so much of it is not as dark, but then at the same time, you've got all of these subplots about Harry learning more about the prophecy and how he's going to have to die or kill. And then, of course, Dumbledore's death at the end is like, ugh,
and this
like
one,
a gut punch.
When it's dark, it's really dark, but it's not all dark.
Yeah. I had forgotten just how much the end of this book hurt.
Yeah.
It's rough.
It is tough.
Okay, and then of course, Hermione's savagery.
I'm going to give Hermione an 8.
I was going to say the exact same thing.
When she uses the confundish charm.
Yes, when she confunds McLagan. That was amazing. And then she straight up asks him out because she knows it's going to annoy Ron the most.
And then she...
Even though she hates him.
And she sticks a bunch of birds on Ron.
Oh. Oh my gosh. Yes, when she attacks him with birds and he has, like, cuts all... Yeah, she's not kidnapping anybody in this book, which will just always be the marker we have to judge everything else by. But she still does some crazy stuff in this one for Hermione.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that brings us to an end. So thanks to Sahara Sky for the use of our theme song, Never Long, Time Goes By, from the album Escapism.
And thank you for listening. If you want to get in touch with us, you can tweet at UnassignedPod over on Twitter, shoot us an email at unassignedreadingpod@gmail.com, or join the discussion on our Facebook group by searching for Unassigned Reading on Facebook. We'd love to hear from you.
And if you really want to make our day, go ahead and take a second to subscribe to the show and then give us a quick rating and review. Just look at those 5 stars waiting to be clicked.
That's right. It only takes a second to do and makes a big difference in helping other people find the podcast.
Or if reviewing podcasts isn't your thing, maybe just consider telling one of your friends. Or for the more hipster among you, you know, you could try carrier pigeon, telegraphs, good old-fashioned postal service. We're really not picky. Just let your friends and fellow book lovers know about the show. You know the drill.
We'll be back with a new episode of Book Talk on Friday, November 9th.
Right, where we'll be discussing the Harry Potter movies and our many thoughts and feelings about them.
We have a lot of thoughts and feelings.
And then we'll be back again on the last Friday of November, that's the 30th for those of you out there wondering, for the final episode of our Harry Potter series where we will cover Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows.
I can't believe it's almost over.
I know, I kind of feel like we've been talking about Harry Potter forever.
I mean, is that really a bad thing though?
Not at all, but I am really excited to start discussing some other books and genres, you know, mix things up a little, especially for our holiday episode on...
Hey, no spoilers.
Okay, all right. Well, in that case, I guess we'll just have to wait and find out. We hope you'll join us again next month, and in the meantime, we leave you with these words of wisdom.
And now, let us step out into the night and pursue that flighty temptress, adventure.